This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Andrew Exum, is a former Army captain who completed his military service 2 months ago. At the age of 23, he led a platoon of Army Rangers in Afghanistan, clearing caves and searching for members of Al-Qaeda. He was also deployed to Kuwait and was part of a classified special operations mission in Iraq. Exum has written a new memoir called This Man's Army, a soldier's story from the front lines of the war on terrorism. Now, you joined ROTC at the University of Pennsylvania because he gave you a scholarship. And you didn't have enough money, in spite of having worked for several years, to pay for your tuition at Penn. Would you have otherwise enlisted?
I think so. I am from the volunteer state, and I also grew up in East Tennessee and in the city of Chattanooga. And I don't think, if you haven't been there or you didn't grow up there, it's tough to really imagine what it's like growing up in that city with the markers from the Civil War just on all the high ground, the cannons, the monuments. And you just get that sense, that feeling that, as a young man, when you come of age, when you become, a young man of the age of 18, 19, 20, it's just your duty to serve in the military. And a couple things kind of exacerbated that sense of service. The first was the fact that my grandfather and his service in World War II always loomed very large on my conscience. I grew up with his medals hanging above me in my bedroom. And the second thing had to have been my classical education. I mean, you read about the ancient polis of Athens or Sparta, and something that went hand in hand with citizenship was service in the military. You couldn't be a real citizen unless you served in the military. It's worth noting you couldn't be a citizen if you weren't male also, but I do believe in the that young men and young women do owe service to their country, especially while they're young, and they can do things that we can't do when we become older.
You flew with your men into Afghanistan. Would you describe the plane and the mood on the plane?
Yeah, well, before I describe that mood, you have to understand what our previous 5.5 months had been like. We deployed right after September 11th as part of the first conventional forces to deploy, and after September 11th, we weren't sure if there were going to be more attacks in the United States, if there were going to be more attacks in the Middle East. So we went to Kuwait and beefed up the security of one of the bases there. And there we pretty much sat for 5.5 months. And we did some convoy escort missions, but we pretty much watched the war in Afghanistan on Fox and CNN just like the rest of America. Whatever Armed Forces Network showed us about the war, that's what we saw. And it was incredibly frustrating. So when the U.S. and the coalition planners were really hurt for ground troops in the battle, what they called Operation Anaconda, the battle for the Shaikat Valley, we were called up and sent from Kuwait, and the mood on the plane was just exuberant. These guys, it was like they'd been released from prison, and the fact that we were ending what we thought was going to be our deployment, and then to be asked to actually do what we thought we were going to do in the first place. We descended into Bagram Airfield in eastern Afghanistan at night, and there were no lights. I mean, there was no ambient light, no moon. It was about as pitch black as you can imagine, with the exception of a few of the lights coming from the control tower and the runway. And they kept it pitch black because there were still attacks on the planes that were coming in, still rockets that were fired at the cargo planes, and that's why they only flew at night as well. But when we woke up that morning, I was just struck by the sheer beauty of what we just descended into. We were in the Panjshir Valley in eastern Afghanistan, and really the foothills of the Himalayas, and the view was quite simply breathtaking, and it was hard to match up that breathtaking view with what we were going to be asked to do, which was in effect a pretty grim task.
Now, there's a moment in your memoir where you describe, I think it was nighttime. And, you're sitting, I guess it was in the Panjshir Valley, absolutely beautiful, surrounded by mountains. And a daisy cutter, one of the really big bombs, is dropped on one of the mountains. And what do you see?
Yeah, that was the first night we landed in the Shaikat Valley. We were in the West on a train feature that they called the Whale. It looked like this feature at the National Training Center at Fort Irwin, California, that was also called the Whale, so they named it as such. And one of my squad leaders and I, we just settled into our position for the night, and it was getting dark, and we were looking across this massive valley towards where we knew some of the Al-Qaeda positions were. And you know, I can't even describe it. Quite literally, you know, we didn't hear an explosion. Obviously, you see the light before you hear anything, and we just saw just this massive red fireball, which is followed by obviously this giant mushroom cloud of smoke, and they dropped, you know, the Air Force had dropped some, I don't know, 5,000-pound bomb, and it literally masked an entire mountain, this giant mountain that had previously loomed large over the terrain. You know, we couldn't even see the mountain anymore. I mean, we, you know, our reaction was just so stunned. And, you know, I describe in the book that we just started laughing, you know, laughing that because we'd never seen anything with that, you know, never couldn't even comprehend that type of military might. And just, you know, out of joy that we weren't on the receiving end of that. Because I've, you know, after seeing the effects of the United States Air Force when it wants to, when it puts its mind to something, it is ugly, it is nasty, and the lives for those on the opposite end are painfully short.
Now, you killed a man during one of your searches. You saw him, shot him, and then after realizing he had a machine gun, released four more rounds, and two other soldiers fired at him too.
Yeah.
And you write in your memoir, "My thought was more amazement than horror. Actions unleashed by my hand had ended the life of this man. I couldn't believe it." Could you describe for us what happened that made it necessary for you to shoot?
Sure. Well, about a week prior, I'd seen my first freshly killed body in combat. One of the other platoons in my company had just killed this guy, and they were in a pretty large position. So I brought up a squad of my guys, and I turned a corner and I see this enemy body that just looked inhuman. This enemy fighter's face was completely gone, and it was really, you know, shocking and horrifying. And it was probably more shocking than what I saw with the fighter that I myself killed. You know, with that incident, I was patrolling with one squad, and I'd sent them to go clear an enemy bunker that I'd seen. And I'm watching this when my artillery sergeant who travels with me, my forward observer, you know, from North Georgia, just across the border from where I grew up, you know, spots this enemy position behind us. And we had been clearing positions all afternoon, and I didn't think it was anything too serious. So I grabbed my radio operator and my machine gun team, and we walk up there. And you know, we advanced pretty stealthily and pretty tactically, and my machine gunner Carl McCulley, who's carrying his pistol at that point, he sees this enemy fighter, and he says, "Sir, I see feet to the right, feet to the right." And I turn and pivot and fire two shots at these feet, and sure enough, the enemy fighter sat up, and you know, I actually couldn't even see his machine gun. But you know, Carl and I ended up killing this guy, and then we came over. And came over this rise in what was pretty restrictive terrain. It was, you know, we shot the guy from only about 10 meters away, and yet it took us a while to just get up to where he was because of the very rocky nature of things. And you know, you see this enemy soldier, or what you hope is an enemy soldier, living out his last moments on Earth. And it was shocking because the machine gun that I saw was an American-made machine gun.
The one that he had,
and he had all this, he had all this American equipment on him, and for the, you know, I tell people the only time I was really, honestly petrified, the only time I was really scared was that moment. And as we searched him, we began to discover that American equipment he had on him was equipment that had been stolen from Americans in a fight about 2 weeks prior on a mountaintop called Taker Gar, in the Shaikot Valley. And my heart rate began to fall a little bit, but at the same time, this enemy fighter was still twitching out his last moments on Earth. I mean, there was nothing we could have done to save him. He was shot multiple times, but at the same time, the juxtaposition between that incident and the incident a week prior is that now I was watching, you know, what was very human, what I could relate to, because I was watching someone in the last moments of their life, and it was much more different.
You mean compared to watching the daisy cutter on the mountain?
Well, right, than that, or then you know, seeing this lifeless body that no longer had a face, that looked inhuman.
Right.
So, you know, very, you know, at once the inhuman and the surreal, you know, became very real and very human.
You were later interviewed by an Army major about the shooting. Your explanation is that a national reporter had observed it, and the military was concerned about how the reporter would interpret the shooting. And, you know, would the reporter think that you used excess force?
Yeah.
And you write, "Whoever heard of excess violence in a war? How could a general who dropped 10,000-pound bombs on enemy soldiers accuse you of being excessive because you fired half a magazine of ammunition at an enemy soldier?" Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, we had a reporter from the Army Times, which is an independent magazine or independent weekly magazine that focuses on Army issues, a guy by the name of Sean Naylor, who I've stayed in touch with. And he was traveling with my platoon at the time. This was before the Army began its embedded reporter program, and had, you know, before it, you know, really started to train reporters on, you know, what they might see on the battlefield. So they were somewhat worried that, you know, he'd be taken aback by the fact that we fired so many shots. And, you know, my battalion commander later saw the scene of where it took place. And, you know, he told me, he said, "First off, you know, judging from the terrain, the fact that the enemy fighter was partially obscured, is in very difficult, rocky terrain. He was in a dug-in position. You know, he didn't have any problem with the fact that we fired so many rounds." And it just made sense as far as the terrain. It made sense for, you know, two soldiers in their first real engagement with an enemy soldier. But at the same time, I guess someone was a little nervous that we'd be portrayed poorly. And of course, that wasn't the case. You know, Sean Naylor wrote a great piece on my platoon for the Army Times, and made both myself and Specialist McCulley look really good. But at the same time, there's definitely that nervousness. And I talk about in the book about how, you know, this is a professional Army, and that's great in so many ways, because we have an Army that really studies tactics. We have officers that make a lifetime study of war and warfare, and how to keep soldiers alive, and how to, you know, how to win battles effectively. But at the same time, you've also got a lot of very image conscious officers, and they, you know, they want things to be reported in a way that makes the unit and themselves look good. So I was frustrated at that whole process, and, you know, my company commander, God bless him, he was frustrated right there along with me. And yes, ma'am, go ahead.
Can you talk a little bit about trying to, you know, way what excessive force means in a war where 10,000-pound bombs are being dropped?
Right. Yeah, it's tough, because it's, you know, how do you, you know, where is that moral calculus? Where is that, you know, what is deemed excessive? What is deemed, you know, what is deemed sane? You know, really kind of the rules go out the window, and it I think it's easy somewhat to drop, you know, 10,000-pound bombs, because you really don't see what happens on the working end of those bombs. You know, nobody's down there recording what happened. They may give a battle damage assessment, but it's not the same as shooting someone and then watching that person die in front of you. It seems to make a very much more real portrayal of war.
We talked a little bit about what it was like for you when you shot an enemy soldier in Afghanistan. I'm interested in hearing what it was like for you when the men you led in the platoon were injured. The first casualty in your platoon was a young man who threw a grenade into a cave, and the shrapnel wounded him. How bad was that wound?
Well, it was a lot worse when we first saw it. We when I came upon the scene, you know, he was sitting there bleeding profusely from his elbow, and I saw you know, two of my other soldiers rapidly trying to staunch this bleeding. And that is certainly something that, it happened probably an hour after we killed that enemy fighter. And so, you know, that's two cold cups of coffee right there. That's two really, you know, two wake up calls as to the realities of war. And that was definitely, something that caused my heart to skip a few beats until we got the bleeding stopped.
Yeah, as the platoon leader, what is your feeling of responsibility when one of your men is injured? Like what, and what's within your ability to actually do?
It's a feeling of intense responsibility. I remember, you know, going into our first mission in Afghanistan and seeing kind of the looks of fear on some of my soldiers' faces, and then looking at my platoon sergeant, and you know, he looked back at me, and I could tell what he was thinking. We both, you know, our thoughts were not with ourselves. It was with the 34 men that we were entrusted with to take to war, to do a mission, and then to bring home. And, you know, there's a British writer, Jeffrey Powell, who led British paratroopers at Operation Market Garden at Arnhem and World War II. And he writes this in his book, Men at Arnhem. He writes about how leaders actually get killed on the battlefield. And it's not by doing anything heroic. It's not by charging any machine gun position single-handedly. It's usually just by doing their jobs. And that's the problem with leaders, is that their obligation to their men and to their mission is so intense that they forget to be scared. And so that's, I would say that your fear is not so much that something's going to happen to you, but that something's going to happen to your men. And that's certainly something that I think weighs on all combat leaders.
Did you forget to be scared?
Yeah. Yeah. And in several cases on several occasions, I think they're, you know, I talk about in the book, there were a couple times which I look back and I'm just like, man, that was stupid. You know, I didn't have to take that risk. But you know,
one of those risks that in retrospect you think was stupid and unnecessary?
Right. One of the things that I write about in the book was one of my squad leaders and I went back into a small little valley, kind of a large gully in a larger valley, in which we'd just blown two ammunition caches, in which we've just blown these two ammunition caches with plastic explosives, and there were secondary explosions going off. There were small arms rounds that were flying through the valley. There were bullets that were basically burning and then exploding as they burned. Same thing with rockets. And we had neglected to detonate two mines, two landmines that were in the middle of this kind of trail leading up a valley. And so we went back, and instead of waiting, you know, prudentially waiting for, you know, a day or so before the explosions died down, the two of us with plastic explosives, you know, draped around our necks, ran back into this valley. And as literally bullets were going above our heads, we sat there, you know, putting these explosives on top of these two landmines. And I tell you, there's not much that's more harrowing than trying to rig plastic explosives on a landmine as things are exploding above your head, because you never know, you know, if that's the landmine exploding or if that's the if that's just something above your head. So, and to keep ourselves off balance, we kept joking back and forth to one another about how stupid it was that we were doing it. And then it was that night, you know, when we kind of settled down for the night, that we were talking together and we were like, man, that really was stupid. And I think, you know, our eagerness to do the right thing and to, you know, get those two mines taken care of, outstripped our common sense. But that's the story of my life. my courage or stupidity outstripping my common sense. So I guess that's consistent with everything else I've done.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with former Army Captain Andrew Exum. He led a platoon of Army Rangers in Afghanistan, clearing caves and searching for members of Al-Qaeda. His new memoir is called This Man's Army. He says that some men in his platoon were born trigger pullers, but many of the men were raised on PlayStation, and they had to be taught to be physically aggressive and fight.
One of my old football coaches at Penn, he one time told me, he asked me, because he knew I was in ROTC, he said, Exum, do you know why we won World War II? I said, no, coach, I don't know why we won World War II. And he said, He said, because we were a nation of football players playing a nation full of soccer players. And, you know, I kind of laughed at that. And, I said, well, Coach, wait a minute. What about, you know, didn't the British invent soccer? And he said, shut up, Exum. And, but, you know, it still stayed with me that, you know, I think something like 90% of the soldiers in World War II played high school football and, you know, grew up being aggressive. You know, now I had a couple football players and you know, a couple athletes in my platoon, but I also had a lot of kids that you know, just grew up playing video games or goofing off or kind of being adrift and then joined the Army. And so, yeah, it's like I write in the book, it is tough, you know, training those kids raised on PlayStation to, you know, actually, you know, be physical and you know, be, you know, like my high school football coaches used to tell me, you know, play with controlled violence, controlled fury. You know, growing up playing football as a 105-pound free safety in East Tennessee, I learned how to be aggressive and how to take my licks. So, but that's something that a lot of people going into the Army did not learn.
Some of the men in your platoon had stress-related problems, particularly as time went on.
Yeah.
One of them had a nervous breakdown. You said, like if a man was crying or something, you said you had no sympathy. You called these men effing pansies.
Yeah.
Why no sympathy for them?
Yeah, and that's first off, because I was immature, and I never said that to their faces, but you know, my company commander caught me muttering that under my breath one time, and he said, you know, you can't judge how other people are going to handle the stresses of combat. You know how you're going to handle it, and you hope that you're going to be as brave as you want yourself to be, but ultimately. Yeah, you don't know what's going on in other people's heads, and that was a lesson that I had to learn, and you know, I recall, you know, one of the guys in my platoon breaking down, crying on the second night of a 4-day patrol, and it you know, my platoon sergeant wisely kept it from me and didn't mention it, and kind of, you know, swept it under the rug, and we left that guy back on our next mission. But it would have made me incredibly angry, because here you are. You know, it'd be one thing if it's just you, you know, if the war is just about your war and just about your fight. However, you know, there are 33 other guys that are counting on you to make the right decisions, that are counting on you to, you know, to be brave, that are counting on you to pull your share. And you're not only endangering your own life, you're endangering their lives. And that's something that I still feel. I read about, reading a lot of the defenses of the deserter, or I believe it's Carmelo Mejia, Sergeant Mejia, who was sentenced for desertion when he came back home from Iraq and refused to go back. You know, reading a lot of the apologies for him and a lot of the defenses, you know, I remember reading Bob Herbert's column in the New York Times. I wanted to scream aloud at the op-ed page, look, you just don't get it. It's one thing if you're just an individual guy and just an independent operator out there, but, you know, a guy like Sergeant Mejia, he had 9 guys counting on him to keep them safe in the town of Ramadi. And so, you know, ultimately, you know, warfare and soldiers, what makes them special is, they're not any better than normal Americans. There's nothing about them that's inherently more honorable, except for one thing, and that's that they make a decision to give themselves and to sacrifice and to serve. And, you know, when you abandon that service, when you abandon that commitment that you've made to your fellow soldiers, you know, I don't think there's anything worse. Now, when we got back, it changed a little bit. Then when guys started having issues of post-traumatic stress, and you really got to give them the benefit of the doubt, because, you know, it's like my company commander told me, you don't know what's going on in that guy's mind. Just because you handled everything okay, and just because you were able to process everything you had to do, doesn't mean that they were able to.
You are no longer in the military.
Right.
But some of the men who were in your platoon are in the military, and several of them are being affected by the new stop-loss policy, which allows commanders to hold soldiers past the date that they're due to leave service if their unit is scheduled to be deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan.
Sure.
Have you heard from any of those men?
Yeah, I sure have. I got involved with the stop-loss policy in my last days in the Army, and I got, you know, the calls from my guys and my platoon, the old platoon of the 10th Mountain Division. And, you know, I'd ceased to be their platoon leader something like 2 years 2 years ago, but those guys still stay in regular touch with me. And you know, a couple of them called to say, "Hey, we're going to Iraq. We just got our deployment orders." And then the second thing they said was, "But I don't know how we're going to go because you know, a quarter of our company is supposed to get out of the Army this summer." And a couple of days later, then they found out how they were all getting stop lost. And my old radio operator, whose closest thing I have to a little brother, was supposed to go back to San Francisco and got stop lost. And you know, that is something that is inherently legal. The Army has the right to do that. It's in the contract. But but at the same time, it made me mad because I felt like one of the reasons we were stop-lossing soldiers was to avoid having a much more difficult discussion, which was whether our Army is really up to the long-term foreign policy commitments we have in both Iraq and Afghanistan, not to mention all the other places that soldiers are deployed in the world. And I think that stop-loss policy, when combined with activation of the individual ready reserve, in other words, bringing soldiers back onto active duty who have already been honorably discharged, I think that's a pretty clear sign that the military is unable to meet those needs. So I ended up writing a op-ed piece in the New York Times and speaking out, you know, trying to affect some change, but unfortunately it didn't help, and all my old soldiers are over in Iraq right now.
What's your status?
I'm still actually on the individual ready reserve, so I guess I could get called up at any time if the Army grows weary of my protests. but we'll see. I've got a pretty banged up knee, so I'm not sure I could pass a physical. But if I did, you know, and they called me back up, I mean, it's part of my duty, you know. If the military calls me, if I don't care if I'm 55 years old and you know can barely walk, if the military says they need me, I'll be there.
Well, you mentioned your knee. You had a really bad knee injury, not in the war, but playing street hockey in the United States, when yeah. a lieutenant fell on your foot,
yeah.
and that popped your knee, and you blew a tendon, and
broke
a bone,
and it's nasty.
So I mean, how ironic is that? You know, you survive Afghanistan, and then you come home, and you get this really bad injury in street hockey.
Yeah, right.
When somebody falls on you.
Yeah, you know, and what made it even more painful is because people told me the exact same thing that you just said. You know, as I'm sitting there bedridden, angry because I'm not going into the big invasion of Iraq. You know, I later served, but you know, I'm all angry because I'm not deploying with my platoon over there. You know, people were like, "Yeah, wow, how ironic it is." You know, you made it all the way back from Afghanistan, didn't get hurt, and now you know you blew your knee out and you're all messed up. And I say, "Yeah, thanks. That's not helping." But the good news was that it did give me the opportunity to write this book, and that's when I really sat down and started writing about my platoon in the 10th Mountain Division, because you got to keep in mind, in January of 2003, you know, our nation was not focused on Afghanistan. We were focused on Iraq already, and I began to worry that, you know, my soldiers' contributions had really kind of been forgotten. So the knee injury ended up being a blessing in disguise, although, you know, I loved running, and I can't run anymore. But, you know, it did give me the time to settle down and write this book.
So what do you plan for the next phase of your life?
Well, I'm on a book tour right now. And then in September, my plan is to head off to the American University in Beirut, where I'll study English Lit and learn Arabic and work on a new book. I'm looking to do a study of Arab youth culture. And so that will take up the next couple of years as I'm compiling interviews and, you know, trying to understand, you know, attitudes about America, about, you know, about the world from an Arab perspective.
Well, Captain Exum, thank you so much for talking with us.
Yeah, no, it was really my privilege.
Andrew Exum's new memoir is called This Man's Army.